This talk is based on a recent paper with Henry Lin, and also like to thank Chenbin Yang for initial collaboration. So the talk is about symmetry algebra and double-scaled SYK. I'm going to start by reviewing a similar symmetry algebra in JT gravity. So let's think about JT gravity. Let's start over here with this Lorentzian picture. So this is JT gravity on an interval. So we have these two boundaries, one on the left and one on the right. And the JT gravity space-time is in between. And we can consider these three operators, the left and right ADM Hamiltonians, and then the length, which is the geodesic distance between the two boundary points. And those three operators we can think about either in this Lorentzian picture or in the Euclidean picture. And these three operators together generate an interesting algebra. So the algebra was worked out in the classical case by Harlow and Wu, and in the quantum case by Henry Lin. And this is what it is. I've drawn it in gray, so you don't worry too much about the details. But it's an interesting algebra of these operators. So we start out with H left, H right, and L. But then when we compute the commutator of H left with L, we get something that we call KL. And then K appears in the other commutation relations, but you don't get any other new operators. So they're just these five operators: H left, H right, K left, K right, and L. Okay. So it looks like a somewhat weird nonlinear algebra, but it's actually a very simple algebra in disguise. So to see that, we can define these three combinations, B, E, and P. Those are functions of H left, H right, and L. And it turns out that the algebra on the previous slide implies that these three operators form an SL2 subalgebra. So their commutation relations are exactly SL2. And the entire algebra with the five generators factors into a product of commuting factors, where we have a Heisenberg algebra generated by L and by this operator here. And then we have a separate SL2 factor, which is generated by these three. So it's actually a very simple algebra. We have an SL2 factor and this Heisenberg algebra of L and its conjugate. OK, so the B, E, and P, these SL2 generators, these are the ones that were studied by Lin, Maldacena, and Zhao. And they act on this Lorentzian JT space-time in this way, by these vector fields. So basically what they do, the B, E, and P operators, they move around the matter within the JT space-time. And the matter doesn't care too much like what the boundary is doing, which is why this is a commuting factor. Commutes with the L factor. Okay. So this algebra determines all kinds of important things in JT gravity, like the maximal Lyapunov exponent, traversable wormhole experiment, the kind of two-sided OPE, correlation functions. We're going to discuss in this talk a deformation of that algebra. It's a deformation of the algebra we just discussed. And this arises in this theory double-scaled SYK, which I'll explain in a second. It's a deformation of that algebra in the sense that it reduces to the JT algebra in a particular limit. OK, so that's what the talk is going to be about. Now, the algebra has various practical applications, simplifying some SYK calculations. And I imagine that that is not of enormous interest to many of the people in the audience. I'm not sure what is of interest in general, but possibly a more interesting thing for some of us is that this deformation is kind of weird because it represents a deformation of something that appears to be quite rigid. That rigid thing is the near horizon Poincaré symmetry of JT gravity. Sorry, let me go back here. So these SL2 generators, they act near the horizon in the center of this diagram as the Poincaré symmetries of the near horizon region. And that seems like kind of a rigid structure. And what we're going to find is an algebra that deforms that. I think that's sort of interesting in its own right. It has these two kind of weird properties. First, the deformed algebra is compatible with a type of discrete geometry. And second, we can take a semi-classical limit where this discreteness goes away. And it turns out in this case, the algebra reduces to SL2, but it's a non-standard SL2, as I'll explain. Okay. So that is the review and motivation. So now let's start by explaining. If there are questions that arise during the talk, please just shout them out. I can repeat them into the microphone. And if something comes up during the talk, please don't hesitate or wait till the end. So I'm going to now start by explaining qualitatively where this algebra comes from. So let's consider some general quantum mechanical system, not yet double-scaled SYK, and let's think about two copies of that system, two entangled copies of the system. And we're going to label states in the tensor product Hilbert space in the same way that David Kolschmeier was labeling states in his talk on Monday, where we take a product of operators like this, and we turn it into a state by acting with it on the left side of the maximally entangled state of the two systems. So for example, if we take this product with some Hamiltonians and two other operators, we can think about that as a maximally entangled state with this product of operators acting on it. And labeling states in this two-sided Hilbert space this way makes it easy to act with H left and H right, because acting with H left just multiplies this string on the left by an H, and acting with H right multiplies the string on the right by an H. So we get these states acting with H left and H right. So this is a way of describing states in the tensor product Hilbert space, entangled states, where acting with H left and H right is very easy. But that's not going to be enough for our purposes, because we need a third operator, which is the analog of the length operator in JT gravity. So H left and H right are good, but they're not everything that we need. So for the analog of the length, we're going to use a multiple of what's called the size operator. So let me explain how the size operator is defined. So first of all, acting on the maximally entangled state, which we represent as just the identity operator, the size is zero. Acting on a state with one fermion, let's say we have a system of fermions. Acting on a state with one fermion, we say the size operator is one. So to be concrete, this state here, psi one, is a maximally entangled state where we acted with a fermion operator on one side. This state here is a maximally entangled state where we acted with the product of two fermion operators, we call the size two. Okay, so this one is slightly trickier, because it looks like there's three fermions there, so we should have size three, but actually two of them are the same, and the Majorana fermion algebra allows us to simplify that to a one fermion state. So really the size operator acting in this state is one. Okay, so that's the definition of the size operator. And the special thing about double-scaled SYK is that H left, H right, and the size operator generate a simple algebra, and that's our target. We want to understand that algebra. Okay. So to explain this, to go further, we need to define what double-scaled SYK is, and also discuss a more subtle labeling of the Hilbert space than the one we've been using. Okay. So this is the definition of the double-scaled SYK model. So it's a limit of the ordinary SYK model, where we take the number of fermions to infinity, that's n, and we also take the number of fermions that participate in each interaction to infinity. This is sometimes called Q, normally called Q in the SYK literature. We're going to call it P. So we take P to infinity, and we also take n to infinity, and we hold fixed this ratio, P squared over n. Okay. Okay, so we can parameterize the ratio in terms of something called lambda. Lambda is 2 times p squared over n. And we could also parameterize it in terms of q, which is e to the minus lambda. So there's two things here, but there's really only one parameter. The model overall has two dimensionless parameters. One of them is this thing that we just defined, it's lambda or q. And that thing controls how semi-classical the model is. In particular, when lambda is small, fluctuations are small. So you can think of lambda as sort of similar to G Newton, or 1 over n. Controls the size of quantum fluctuations. The other dimensionless parameter is the inverse temperature beta times the scale of the Hamiltonian, J. And that acts as a kind of coupling where high temperatures, which means small beta, are more weakly coupled, and low temperatures, which means large beta, are more strongly coupled. So this one is kind of vaguely similar to the Atuft coupling in n equals 4 supermills. So those are our two parameters. And that's the double scale SYK model. We're going to define matter operators following this reference here by a similar formula to the Hamiltonian itself, but with an independent set of couplings. And we'll label matter operators by the size. So this has S fermions, so it's size S operator. Okay. Right, so correlation functions are computed in double-scaled SYK by the following kind of fun procedure. We sum over what are called all possible chord diagrams. So chord diagrams represent Wick contractions of these random couplings. So here's a simple example of that. Suppose we're computing trace of the Hamiltonian to the third power times a matter operator times Hamiltonian to the third power times a matter operator. So let's arrange, think about that trace is represented by this circle. And we put three Hamiltonians, then a matter operator, then three Hamiltonians, then a matter operator. So the observable on the left-hand side determines the ordering and type of things on the boundary here. And then we sum over all ways we can connect them in chord diagrams. We can pair them up. So we sum over all Wick contractions between those things. And those Wick contractions represent the couplings that are part of the definition of the Hamiltonian or the matter operator. And the rule for evaluating this diagram, I'm not going to explain where it comes from, but just state it. The rule is that you get a factor of q, that's e to the minus lambda, for each intersection between Hamiltonian chords, and you get a factor of q to the delta for intersections between a Hamiltonian chord and a matter chord. So delta is equal to S, the size of the matter operator, divided by P. Okay, so we can use those rules to evaluate this diagram. If you look at it, you see that there are two intersections between black Hamiltonian chords and themselves, and then there are three intersections between the green matter chord and the black Hamiltonian chord, so it evaluates to this thing. Okay, so that's how you calculate correlation functions, and these authors did like an amazing job calculating correlation functions using those rules. One nice thing you can do with these chord diagrams is you can cut them open to get a kind of interesting Hilbert space. And that was studied by these authors, and especially in a recent paper by Henry Lin. So let's look at this diagram we started with. We cut it open, let's say along this sort of time-symmetric slice there, and we get a ket state that looks like this. So we're going to represent that state. Just think about the chords they're crossing the exposed slice there. And there's one Hamiltonian chord, one matter chord, and one Hamiltonian chord. So it looks like this. So that's what the state looks like along this slice. So we're going to represent that as a state that we'll either write in either of these two notations, either explicitly listing the chords that appear or writing the number of chords to the left of the matter chord and the number of chords to the right. So in general, NL, NR represents a state like this, where we have NL matter chord, Hamiltonian chords, then a matter chord, then NR. Hamiltonian chords. Okay, this is a little bit different from the previous labeling scheme for states, because some of the operators, some of these Hamiltonian operators might have been contracted. So before we had some scheme where we just label states according to the insertions of operators on the boundary. So this would correspond to this state here, H squared, O, H squared, with two Hamiltonians and O and then two Hamiltonians. But in our new Hilbert space, this chord Hilbert space, that state expands out to a superposition of a bunch of different states, depending on whether those Hamiltonian chords are contracted with each other and in what pattern. So these are two different ways of describing this two-sided Hilbert space, and you can expand states in either way. The advantage of these states, where we label them by the chords, is that these states have a definite eigenvalue of the size operator. In particular, the size divided by p is what's called the chord number. So apologize for all these definitions. We're almost finished with definitions. But the chord number is just the number of chords appearing in a state where the matter chord counts as delta chords, because it has size delta. So the chord number acting on one of these states is NL plus delta plus NR. So now we have a Hilbert space where the size operator acts in an extremely simple way. Yeah?
Did you tell us, you haven't told us enough to figure out what that superposition, have you, or?
Okay, so the question was, have I told you enough to figure out what this superposition is? And no, not really, but I'll tell you now. So the way you get it is you start out with this state here, and then you just consider possible contractions, and you evaluate them with the chord rules on the previous slide. So for example, a state where we put this one here would come with a factor of q times q to the delta, and we would sum over the different ways that they could be contracted, and each of those gives a term on the right-hand side. So it's not super simple when you have large numbers, but it's a concrete algorithm. Yeah, thank you for asking. Okay, so last definition. I think we're going to define our analog of the L operator as lambda times the chord number. So for finite lambda, this is a discrete variable. And in the semi-classical limit where lambda goes to zero, it becomes continuous. Okay. All right. So, we now have a collection of states where the L operator acts extremely simply, and turns out the HL and HR operators act reasonably simply on these states. So we can compute how they all act together and compute their algebra. To do so, it's helpful to I'm going to have to go back a slide again. It's helpful to break up the Hamiltonian into two terms. So let's think about this state here. And let's imagine acting with HL. So that means we add a black dot here. If we add a black dot here, then it has a black line coming off of it. And the one possibility is that creates a new chord. So it could turn this state 1, 1 into 2, 1. Another possibility is that it could annihilate this chord or that chord. It could get contracted with one of the chords that previously exists. So it could turn 1, 1 into 0, 1 or 1, 0. Those are the three possibilities when you act with the Hamiltonian. So it's helpful to, it's nice to decompose the Hamiltonian into a term where it increases the number of chords and a term that decreases the number of chords and treat those as two separate operators. Then we can work out the algebra of those operators and our length operator, chord number. So some of the commutation relations are super easy, like this one. This just says that a dagger increases the number of chords, and that was our definition. And this one says that a decreases the number of chords. Okay, now to compute their commutator with each other is like not hard, but not something I'm going to explain right now. And you get this algebra here, a dagger minus q times a dagger a is equal to 1. This algebra that we've written here is what's called a q-deformed harmonic oscillator. And so far, up to this point, we have the algebra of two q-deformed harmonic oscillators, one for the left, one for the right. It turns out these are not quite independent. And although the A's commute with each other and the A daggers commute with each other, A left and A dagger right do not commute. And their commutator is given by this expression involving the length operator, the chord number. Okay. So that's actually it. That's the algebra. That is the entire algebra. And it looks like something that, well, it looks nice. So. And the reason I wrote it this way, this is the most beautiful way we found to write the algebra. It looks very appealing and elegant. But you can also write it in terms of h left, h right, the length operator, k left, and k right. And if you do so, it looks similar to those gray expressions from the first slide, with just a couple of extra terms on the right-hand side. So it looks similar to the JT algebra, but just slightly different. at low temperatures, these extra terms vanish, and so that justifies my claim that this is a deformation of the JT algebra. So the algebra that you get here reduces to the JT algebra in low temperature limit. Okay. So in JT gravity, the most interesting part of the algebra, the most useful part of the algebra, was this SL2 subalgebra. And we would like to see if we can find an analog of that in this case. So we can use exactly the same formulas as in JT gravity case, involving commutators of H with L and e to the L itself, to define three operators B, E, and P. And if you do so, you find that these generate some kind of subalgebra. And it turns out that it also commutes with L. And so this is a generalization of the SL2 subalgebra from the JT gravity case. And mathematically, what it is, it's a very big but proper subalgebra of something called the quantum algebra, this thing. In the semi-classical limit, where lambda goes to 0, q goes to 1, the algebra of these things simplifies to SL2. So this algebra that we get here, the subalgebra of this thing, simplifies just to SL2. But it has a strange, the SL2 algebra that you get, I should have explained one other thing. So remember that the double-scaled SYK model has two dimensionless parameters. One is lambda, and one is the temperature. Here we're taking lambda to 0, but we're not saying what we've done with the temperature. So there's still one parameter left. And for generic values of that parameter, we always get SL2, but it has a weird action that depends on the temperature. So there's one parameter remaining, so something still should depend on it, and the action of this SL2 on the boundary depends on the temperature. And this can be explained by introducing something called the fake circle. And so I'm going to explain that now. So this fake circle is a tool for understanding the representation of this SL2. So here's what we do. And this is going to seem strange. I apologize. Well, OK, I guess I did apologize. I don't know if I should have. But here's the thermal circle. And let's think about parameterizing this by an angular coordinate, theta, that goes from 0 to 2 pi. So just as an operation we can do on this circle, let's cut it in half, and then take the two halves and glue them into a larger circle, where the larger circle has a larger circumference by a factor of 1 over v. OK, what is v? V is a parameter between 0 and 1 that is determined by the temperature. So it's determined by this equation. And that determines v between 0 and 1. So this circle has a circumference that is larger by a factor of 1 over v. So if we try to glue this thing to that thing, it doesn't quite cover the whole circle. It only covers part of it on the top and part of it on the bottom. In particular, it covers a fraction v of the circle. OK, so we do that. And now we define a coordinate phi that goes from 0 to 2 pi on this larger circle. And so there's a map between phi and theta for this part, for the ket. And there's a map between phi and theta for this part up here, which is the bra. OK, so that is a definition of a something. And this simplifies the action of the SL2. So in particular, the generators, B, E, and P, act on operator insertions, O of theta, in this way. So the B operator, let's look at the B operator first. How does it act? It acts as a translation in phi. And the E operator acts in this slightly more complicated way. A simpler way to think about this is that what these things are is these transformations here, these are the boundary limits of bulk hyperbolic isometries that you guys are probably familiar with, acting on a hyperbolic disk that fills in this fake circle. Okay. So that is just a fact about how these B, E, and P operators act on boundary insertions. So it acts like an SL2. These things satisfy an exact SL2 symmetry, exact SL2 algebra. And the way that SL2 is realized on the boundary is in this way. You think about cutting the boundary, putting it on this bigger fake boundary, and then act with the simple SL2 transformations on that fake boundary. All right. What do you want to, well, so the question was, can I explain the factor of I? So that factor of I is important for this thing to be a Hermitian operator. So if you do not have that I there, it would not be a Hermitian operator. So what do these fake portions of the fake circle mean? So let's try to understand that. So here I've cut that fake circle in half. And let's imagine inserting an operator somewhere here in the real part of the circle that got glued onto this larger circle. Let's insert it here. By acting with the symmetry generators, we can move it into the fake region, because B just acts as a rotation. So we can definitely rotate it from here up into the fake region. So what does that mean? If we don't introduce the fake circle, we could explain this as rotating. It's like moving this point past the edge of this half of the thermal circle. So in other words, it corresponds to a Euclidean time fold, where we move this point up here, include a Euclidean time fold. So that's one way of thinking about what this fake region is. It's like inserting a Euclidean time fold in the boundary. But we can ask more directly, what does this state look like in the chord Hilbert space that we've defined? So let's think about that. So let's start out not in this semi-classical limit. Let's go back to the exact theory at finite lambda. And go back to the exact theory and use exact formulas for these generators and start with a state where we start out a matter particle all the way to the right of the chord Hilbert space. So we consider this state right here, where we have a whole bunch of Hamiltonian chords, and then we have a matter chord all the way on the right side. So that corresponds to inserting an operator at the boundary of the physical region here, all the way to the right side of this black line. So that's a state where we have NL equals N, the total number of chords, and NR equals 0. So now let's evolve this thing back into the physical region using our symmetry generators. You get a wave function as a function of NL that looks like this. So it's kind of moved back a little bit, so there's a peak, some intermediate point. So this is the wave function that you get if you evolve it back into the physical region. Okay, now what happens if you evolve it the other direction, into the fake region? Well, you get some state, and this is a plot of the wave function. It's this crazy, very large oscillating wave function. And it looks extremely impractical to work with, and it is extremely impractical to work with. In particular, in the limit where lambda goes to 0, that's like a continuum limit. This thing is oscillating on the lattice scale, on the scale of lambda. And in the limit lambda goes to 0, you think you should ignore these rapidly oscillating wave functions. But we need to keep them. We need to keep them in order to have representations of this SL2. And so what this fake portion of the boundary is it's a way of having a smooth parameterization of these very crazy looking states. They're actually not crazy states. And the fake boundary gives you a smooth way of thinking about them. Okay, so that's the explanation of this fake circle. So let me now discuss an application of this algebra. So so we can start with the exact formulas for the B and the E generators in terms of the Hamiltonians and the length that I showed you a few slides ago. And we can expand those formulas to first order around the thermal field double state, assuming that fluctuations are small, so lambda is small. So if you do that, you get the following equation. You get B equals this thing. And I've rewritten it so that the thing on the left-hand side is H right minus H left, and B is on the right-hand side. That's because I want to think about this as an equation for H right minus H left, not as an equation for B. Okay. And similarly, if you write the equation for E, you get E equals like this L plus some terms involving the Hamiltonian. I also rewrote that one so that we can think about this as an equation for L. So we can write L, and we can write HR minus HL in terms of these operators. Okay, why is this useful? Let's focus on the first equation for a second. The first equation writing h right minus h left in terms of the B operator. The SL2 algebra for B, for the generators, implies that when under the adjoint action, so when you take commutators, this B operator has eigenvalues plus or minus I. That's just part of the SL2 algebra. And the eigenvectors are E plus or minus P. So this is two of the three equations that define the SL2 algebra. So that means that time evolution by HR minus HL leads this operator here to grow exponentially. So just from the algebra, we find that this this operator grows exponentially with this particular exponent, e to the 2 pi v over beta times t. So this reproduces the fact that this here is the Lyapunov exponent of the large P SYK model. And it arises here as a consequence of the symmetry, as a consequence of this weird SL2 symmetry. Yeah, V is related to the temperature. It's a way of parameterizing the temperature. So V, just think of it as going, forget this equation. It goes between 0 and 1, where V equals 1 is low temperature. That's like the ordinary, that's like the JT limit. You just ignore V in the JT limit. And V equals 0 is high temperature. So if we now look at this equation for the Lyapunov exponent, we see that like it could be a little less than 2 pi over beta if V is less than 1. But it still comes just from the symmetry algebra. Okay. Another thing about this equation that is maybe more interesting is that it identifies the operator that grows exponentially. The operator that grows exponentially identifies the rate at which it grows, but also identifies the operator itself. And that's E plus B, E plus P. And so that is what people sometimes call the Pomeron or Scramblon. It's the operator that grows exponentially, and the leading growing operator. And the weird thing here is that you find that that operator is a symmetry. It's a symmetry generator. That's familiar in JT gravity, but here we see that it's true at all temperatures in double-scaled SYK. Okay, so let's discuss, kind of put these things together to discuss an application to the traversable wormhole. So in the traversable wormhole story, what we want to do is we want to compute this here. So let me unpack that. We start with our two boundaries. We act with an operator VR on the right side. Then we do this two-sided operator that breaks the traversable wormhole, or makes it traversable. And then we compare by computing an inner product with a state where we have just V on the left side. So kind of the goal of the traversable wormhole protocol is to make this large. Okay, so what is this? It's the operator that you insert here to make the wormhole traversable is e to the I times something times the length operator. So we can analyze that using our formulas. In particular, we can work out the time evolution of this length operator. So that's what we're trying to work out here. So let me explain this formula. This is the key to the traversable wormhole, is to work out how the length operator evolves under time evolution. And let's go back to the previous slide. Here we wrote the length operator as the E generator plus something involving the Hamiltonians. Okay, so, well, something involving the Hamiltonians here will not grow under time evolution. The E operator that appears here will grow under time evolution, and its growing piece will be this Pomeron piece, proportional to E plus P. And that part will grow with this Lyapunov exponent. So for a large time evolution, we can approximate this operator here as just E plus P times the exponentially growing factor. OK, now if we substitute that into the previous equation, then we get this thing we want to compute to assess the traversability is equal to a matrix element of this E plus P operator, where A here is like G times E to the T. Okay. And so getting to this point, we use the algebra once. Now we use it again because we can act with this symmetry generator on this bra, on the ket state, using the transformations of the operators under this SL2 symmetry that I wrote down earlier, the differential operators with respect to phi. We can use that transformation to actually compute this. And this agrees with a formula that was computed by Gao and Jaffris in the large PSYK model. So, but it turns out that there's something kind of interesting about this formula, which is that we can imagine maximizing this formula over A, maximizing the magnitude of this formula over A. So that corresponds to choosing the time of the traversable worm, time parameter of the traversable wormhole, and trying to maximize the inner product over the value of T. And it turns out that the maximum magnitude of this function, if you maximize it over real A, is exactly 1. It's exactly 1 for any value of V. And so that means that for that very special value of T, the traversability kind of works as well as it possibly could, in the sense that acting with the perturbation here, and then doing this Gao-Jaffris wall perturbation, gives you exactly the state that you would have obtained by acting with V on the left side. So with the, and that's an exact statement for any temperature in the semi-classical limit. And it's secretly a consequence of the fact that this Scramblon or Pomeron operator is a symmetry generator, even at finite temperature. Okay. So, this is my last contentful slide. What we've discussed so far is this symmetry algebra for the double-scaled SYK. And maybe the question that we should have analyzed, or the question that people would like analyzed, and maybe somebody should analyze in the future, is like, what is the bulk dual to double-scaled SYK? Some question like that. And it's not that like I know the answer, I'm sort of explaining it poorly. I don't know the answer. We don't have a, maybe there is no good answer to that question. We've explained this symmetry algebra because that's something that we can compute and understand and generalize the JT gravity answer for. So let me just make some comments about the bulk and why it is that we only analyzed the symmetry algebra and we didn't answer the question, like, what is the bulk dual? Okay, so an idea is to try to use the chords to say the chord diagrams are the bulk dual of SYK, of double-scaled SYK. And can you use that to derive a geometrical theory of the bulk? So one naive idea is you take this chord diagram. So here are your typical chord diagram that was Monte Carlo sampled with 400 chords. And it looks like maybe if we make 400 much bigger, we will get some kind of a dense thing that could be a geometry. So perhaps we could define a geometry using this chord diagram. There's a problem with that. The problem is that the chord diagrams actually do not define a graph. So I've drawn here a graph with intersecting chords, but the chords do not define a graph. And the reason for that is that all they know about is which set of other chords they intersect. They don't know in what order they intersect them. So if I drew this chord diagram with straight lines, chords are straight lines in flat space, but we could have drawn them with straight lines in hyperbolic space or straight lines in like some other metric. And that will change the graph. So a chord diagram is less than a graph. It is less than a geometry. It does not define a geometry. However, there is something that is invariant, which is the number. So let me say it another way. You could think about the chord diagram as a graph modulo an equivalence class, which is like Yang-Baxter moves that move an intersection, rearrange the intersections of the chords. And so we can think about this as where the Yang-Baxter moves are a kind of gauge symmetry. Thanks. And there's a gauge invariant quantity, which is the total length, total number of intersections that occur along a given chord. So the total length between two points is well-defined. So the chord diagrams are not enough to define a geometry, but they are enough to define a length. And the algebra that we discussed depends only on the length. It depends on the left Hamiltonian, the right Hamiltonian, and the length. So that's an aspect of the geometry that we are able to generalize. Other aspects of the geometry maybe can be generalized, but they require you to think about this problem in a different way, picking some gauge, or require some further discussion. So that's why we found it relatively straightforward to generalize this algebra, but without you know, answering the question exactly is what the optimal description of the bulk. Okay. Sorry for this slightly vague comment. So let me summarize. So JT gravity has this symmetry algebra that is Heisenberg times SL2. And double-scaled SYK gives a deformation of that algebra that acts on this discrete chord Hilbert space. There's a limit where it becomes continuous, and it becomes SL2 algebra, but on this weird extended circle. And well, the algebra has various applications. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Douglas. Questions? One up here.
Thanks. That Scramblon operator and its exponential growth under time evolution, it looks like if that had been an algebra in Minkowski space, it would have been a null translation. Is that right?
Yes.
And so then it wouldn't have surprised me. So what's weird is that that Minkowski space algebra carries over to this finite temperature JT background. Is that the right way to think about the surprise?
Well, so that feature is also present in just in JT gravity, that this Pomeran operator, it's like P plus operator or P minus operator.
Right, but I would, yeah. Does it apply, is finite temperature like a two-sided black hole?
Yeah.
But so in that case, I wouldn't have thought I had a null translation.
Oh, no, you do have that symmetry. It's like a translation along the horizon.
Isn't the bifurcation point a special location along the horizon?
Yeah, it's important that, right, so for a typical generic black hole, you have a version of this symmetry close to the horizon. In ADS2, you have this exact symmetry for the entire black hole space-time.
I see. So it's simpler in two dimensions, I'm thinking about.
Yeah, you have these near-horizon symmetries extend to the entire black hole space-time in two dimensions. The weird thing was not that it was Lorentzian. It was that the SL2 symmetries did not, they kind of don't preserve the physical boundary. They move you also into these other states that correspond to Euclidean time folds or whatever. That was the weird thing here, that the representations of that symmetry kind of move you outside the naive states you would have included.
I see. Thank you.
We'll take one here.
Hi. So I thought you said that this QD-form algebra was a sub-algebra of UQSL2, but I'm a bit confused because I thought you had three generators, and the UQSL2 also has three generators, so why is it a sub-algebra?
Oh, yeah, actually, well, so really it has four, so yeah, so UQSL2 has these four generators, and I wrote three here, but they create a fourth, and
is this really UQSL2 or the modular double? Because doesn't UQSL2 just have three generators?
Well, it has four, unless you want to include like the inverse. Like I guess people normally call it K, E, F, and K inverse. And so it's weird because, yeah, so we have some algebra that's generated by four things. So this E, B, and P were part of a subalgebra that has a fourth generator. And the UQSL2 also has four generators, and with these algebras, it's hard to figure out whether one algebra is isomorphic to the other algebra. They're not obviously isomorphic, but maybe they're not obviously isomorphic. But Henry found an ingenious argument to show that it is not isomorphic to the entire algebra. So it is you can show that it's a subalgebra because you can solve for R generators in terms of the UQ generators, but and Henry found an ingenious proof that there's no reverse of that. So you cannot solve for the UQ generators using these ones. So it is actually a proper subalgebra, but it seems to be an extremely big proper subalgebra. Yeah.
Other questions?
Susskind has this conjecture that double skilled SYK is dual to the sitter. Do you have any comments on that? Or
yeah, I can make. Let me make two comments about that. So in the way Lenny thinks about this double scaled SYK, he's interested in extremely long times from our perspective, and all the things that we that conventionally studied about the double scaled SYK model all happen from Lenny's perspective on like very short times, and they are not of interest to him. They describe things that he calls confined. So he's not interested in the things that have been computed so far in double scale SYK. So he's interested in some other very slow mode. So I think something he would like to consider is you take like some complex double scaled SYK model, and you study something like a charge operator, but you slightly break the U1 symmetry, so it's not exactly conserved. And then he wants to study correlation functions of this not quite conserved charge operator, so it would decay very slowly and be sensitive to very long time scales. And that's a technical difference between the aspects of the model that he is interested in and the aspects that we are interested in. That's the most objective thing I think I can say.
We can take one more, I think. So I think Shreya actually had her hand up.
In the picture that you showed of the wave function, when you move the real circle, that was still centered around some value of NL.
Yeah.
Did that have some interpretation?
I think it's a good question. I think that depends on lambda. So I think as we take lambda very small, I don't think that the value that it's centered at is preserved. I think it might get closer to the edge, but I'm not sure. So the clearest answer is I'm not sure, but I sort of suspect not.
Let's all thank Douglas again.